My next workshop is going to be all about how to help yourself reach out during times of need and do that without feeling like a burden, which is a really common struggle for those of us who suffer with chronic pain and illness, because it can feel like, you know, we're always in a space that other people don't want to be around. So we're going to really dig into some of the barriers here and then help you understand what your personal barriers are and then how you can start to overcome them in a way that feels good and isn't just forcing yourself to do hard things without any understanding of what consequences can come at the end of that. So we'll talk about why it's normal to feel like a burden, how to kind of compensate in a healthy way for that, and give some really practical tools and strategies as well. So if you want to attend that, it's going to be April 20th at 10 a.m. That's a Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern. And it will come with a replay if you can't make it live, and it will come with a workbook. So feel free to sign up in the show notes. The link is right there. And I look forward to meeting you. It is a live workshop. So if you can come live and I get to meet you, that's even better. And if not, then the replay will be there waiting for you.
The Chronic Illness Therapist podcast is meant to be a place where people with chronic illnesses can come to feel heard, seen, and safe while listening to mental health therapists and other medical professionals talk about the realities of treating difficult conditions. This might be a new concept for you, one in which you never have to worry about someone inferring that it's all in your head. We dive deep into the human side of treating complex medical conditions and help you find professionals that leave you feeling hopeful for the future. I hope you love what you learn here, and please consider leaving a review or sharing this podcast with someone you love. This podcast is meant for educational purposes only. For specific questions related to your unique circumstances, please contact a licensed medical professional in your state of residence.
Becky Mitchum is a speech-language pathologist and certified brain injury specialist. Speech-language pathology is her encore career, coming to it after 25 years as a professional violinist. Arkansas Speech-Language Therapy is Becky's newly minted private practice as a personal brain trainer coach. She addresses a wide range of conditions from dyslexia in childhood to dementia in adulthood. And the why for her private practice is the observation that over the 11 years that she's been treating children and adults, it's become increasingly difficult to provide the level of attention and quality of intervention with traditional speech-language therapy that clients deserve. She sees this particularly so with our most vulnerable friends, those who have chronic degenerative conditions. Becky's coaching framework draws from her background as an SLP and from the principles of neuroplasticity. She has extensive training and pedagogies for dyslexia, training in neurologic music therapy, incorporates her art skills as a freelance illustrator to solidify the language concepts in coaching, and has training from the American Hippotherapy Association to use horses in animal-assisted coaching. Hippotherapy brings Becky full circle back to her first career as a professional violinist, since the hair on the violin bow comes from the tail of a horse. You can find more about Becky by visiting her website at arkansasspeechtherapy.com. I would love to hear about, you know, your experience, where you practice now, and what you're doing these days in your professional work.
Okay, sure. So I'm a speech language pathologist. I'm also a certified brain injury specialist, and I have worked across the lifespan, from childhood dyslexia now through adult dementia. So I resigned in August from a school for dyslexia and other language-based disorders to start a private practice. So this is new for me, and I'm still learning all the ropes about that. But I have not yet even started marketing for the children. That's going to start in January after everybody gets back into the swing after the holidays. So right now I have adults, and every one of them has dementia. So, but I started my private practice because what I'm seeing in healthcare for my lane that I'm in is documentation and the restrictions of insurance and just the regulations are strangling us. I think speech therapists, probably all therapists, including your field, we go into this completely with altruistic motives. We want to help people. Our hearts are in the right place, and it's just gotten harder and harder to do that. We're with productivity thresholds, and I've discovered that some insurances won't reimburse, depending on where the therapy takes place, won't reimburse in the community, only in their home or in a private clinic, even though you're going to get the best bang for your buck if you're out there in the community where they're having problems. So anyway, as a private speech language pathologist who takes only private pay, I don't participate in federal or private insurance, I can tailor their treatment to be so life participation functional for them. And we can go as long as the person needs. We can, it's just a very, it's a real partnership that I so far, it's just been a really effective way to help these sweet people who are struggling with a new normal with dementia. So anyway, that's why I started. That's my why, to provide more attention and better quality than what I was seeing when I was on salary for a company, regardless the population I was treating. So,
yeah, I'm curious.
That's my story.
Yeah. Did you get into working specifically with dementia for any personal or specific reasons, or was it just that kind of happened?
It just kind of happened. When I was in grad school, the head of our department was Catherine Bayless. She is a seminal author in dementia. So I was her grad assistant, and I was really intrigued by things we were learning. That program where I graduated was heavy in neuro. Some programs are heavier in cleft palate, or some were heavier in pediatrics or whatever. Anyway, with Catherine Bayless, it really intrigued me. Just so I was curious about it even back in grad school. Things like the earlier you're diagnosed with dementia, the faster you unravel cognitively, which is just one of the just very, very cruel tricks about dementia. But when I went into private practice, it just sort of fell in my lap.
I'm curious, is there a reason for that we know of?
So, I'm not an expert on dementia, and I don't pretend to be, so I'm not sure that we do know. I don't know, but they call it early onset dementia. You unravel faster, so the prognosis... the goal is always in therapy, the goal is always going to be to maintain function, because this is why dementia, I was really interested when you approached me about talking about dementia as a chronic illness, because dementia, you don't come back from that unless it's caused from medication. If you have a UTI, that can cause symptoms of dementia. But unless it's something like that, it's not reversible. You don't fix dementia. It is degenerative. It is progressive. It is chronic. So, I don't know why the earlier it is, the worse it is for you, but the prognosis is not good if you are diagnosed at a young age. And by young, I mean 60s. Would be considered young or younger. I can't think of her name right now. There was a She was a basketball coach at one of the big schools, and she was diagnosed a few years ago with it. But anyway, so and it's a spectrum, just probably like every disease. There's a spectrum where you fall on that. So You can't have a crystal. Nobody's got a crystal ball to say, all right, Becky, you've been diagnosed with it at this age, therefore a year from now, it's going to look like this or this or this. It's going to progress differently for each person. But it's very unfortunate that the younger you are, the worse your prognosis.
I'm curious what, as a speech and language pathologist, what your role is then with these patients. And maybe you can talk a little bit to younger how you would work with someone who's maybe a younger diagnosed, where you do know that it's going to be this quicker progression, more likely, versus someone who's diagnosed at a much older age.
Sure. So I always look at the symptoms rather than, you know, it's because it's different for everybody. So regardless their age, I look at how they're functioning then. And when you talk about speech language pathology involvement, there's a lot of misconceptions about what a speech language pathologist does. We call them SLPs, or some people just say ST for speech therapy. But there's the speech component, which is how you produce sounds. That can be also what the traditional understanding of speech language, which is lisps, you know, somebody who speaks with a lateral lisp or a frontal lisp. There's lisping, there's stuttering. You know, there's the oral motor component and the motor planning part of speech. That's part of what we do. But most of what we do is the language component, which is cognitive linguistic. So, and that is, think about anything you do that doesn't start with thought, anything you do. So the way we think and how you predict and how you infer and all the frontal lobe functions of being able to start a project and finish a project and self-monitor, we call that metacognition. Those are all the things that come into play with dementia. So for me, when I'm working with somebody, regardless their age, I look at how are they functioning now and with dementia, because like I said earlier, our goal is to try to maintain function as long as possible. And so I would look at where are you now? And because I'm private pay, I don't have the degree of documentation that I did when I was under insurance constraints and with the companies I've worked for. But I take data because my data drives how to tweak and change the techniques we're using to help you maintain. And as far as that goes, I heavily, heavily involve the caregiver. So I will never be an expert on your loved one the way the wife or the husband will be for their partner. So a lot of what I do is caregiver training and really encouraging input from that caregiver. So let's say somebody is struggling with, let's just say getting dressed in the morning and they're taking too long, and that's part of that frontal lobe executive function of initiation. They may have to hear you ask them 12 times, right, to get ready. And then when they do, they don't know where their shirts are or whatever. So a lot of it is helping them. You become their frontal lobe for them by organizing the space. It's easier for all of us to live and function in an organized place. So for them, I might go into the closet, and we're doing hands-on, you know, problem solving. I will say the patients I have are not, these are busy. They're just retired, but they're world travelers. They have hobbies. They ride their bikes. I mean, these are not, you know, that's another thing that, I know I'm hopping topics here, but that's another thing in our country. We think about dementia and we think the worst. We think the most severe, but there's a whole spectrum. There are many stages of dementia. The ones I have right now are, we're catching them where there is still some learning that can happen. So I'm teaching them strategies, how to have a memory section of their kitchen or whatever, with a dry board and to-do lists. And we, you know, talk about there's no shame in using sticky notes, you know.
Yeah.
So just strategies on how to maintain what they can do. Here's a real life example. We had a gentleman who has a chair in his closet because he was unsteady on his feet getting dressed. So he would sit down, which is really good. It's a great strategy to stay safe, sit down when you're putting your pants on or whatever. But he was always sitting on his eyeglasses, and they'd already broken like four different pairs. And this was really bothering the wife, rightly so. So I took a picture of his eyeglasses and I laminated it, and I put a big red X through it. And I just laid that on the chair as a reminder, that's not where you should put your glasses, right?
I love that.
So it was a visual cue for him. And would that work for somebody else? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe they're not having a problem sitting on their glasses. So it's a life participation approach. That's the gold standard. So for that man, he never broke his glasses again by sitting on them. So that's just an example. So can we maintain that? As long as that picture is on that chair, he's not going to sit on that chair if his glasses are there. So, you know, then there'll be some other problem, some other issue. You know, a week later, I show up for his session. I see my people in their homes, which is a wonderful gift to them. They don't have to navigate. They all can drive. I mean, not the people with dementia. They've lost that. But their spouses don't want to drive in traffic to get, you know, they just love having somebody come, the luxury of having somebody come into their homes. So the next week I might get there and find out, okay, the glasses aren't a problem, but now this person tried to light the gas fireplace and the flue wasn't open. That's a serious, thing. So we try to problem solve that. And I try as best I can to let them maintain autonomy. So it's not ever me as a speech language pathologist telling them, I think this is what you should do. It's, well, how did that work for you? Helping them, that's that metacognitive component. How did that work for you? Then they're able to say, yeah, it didn't work so well for me. Well, and so we talk through, well, what could we do differently next time? So you're guiding them, but you're not telling them, because these are intelligent. They've had full lives. Some of them have had owned their own company, speak multiple languages when they were at their peak. So letting them problem solve and arrive at the idea with guided questions helps them maintain a sense of independence and pride. And because what I see with this chronic illness is so much depression and just, you know, one of my patients put it this way. In fact, his testimony is on my website. He said, I had lost my want to try, and he found it again. So if you can help them want to try, then they're halfway there, you know?
Yeah.
I
was getting curious about some of the emotional components. And when you said maintaining autonomy, I mean, that's the thing, right? So you're not just coming in saying, do this, do that, do this. It's like, it's a collaborative process. You're giving them autonomy back.
Yes, yes. And they will lose that as time, you know, because it's progressive. But that's one of the big things. If we, and this is what the wives, all right now, the people I'm treating are all men. That's just how it has shaken out. So the wives are telling me, they'll text me after a session because they have my personal number. That's part of the concierge private. Mm-hmm. But they'll text me or they'll call me and they'll say, this, it's like a booster shot for 2 days, 3 days after a session with me. They feel like they're respected. They feel like they can do something. Instead of like a baby bird with its beak open, just waiting to be fed. Like this one wife said after a session, he said, I'm going to make my own coffee. Well, that's a whole number of steps that have to happen in the correct sequence to make a good cup of coffee. We hadn't talked about that in a session. And he only needed help with one step. But the fact is that he got up and tried instead of just slink. You know, she said he would just get up and not even get dressed, just sit in his chair all day. And that's the worst thing you can do for your brain, whether you have dementia or not, is inactivity. But that depression that takes over, that dark sense of they're aware enough in their stage. All of my patients are aware they know what they have and they know it's getting worse. But so they're depressed because they're aware. It almost would be a blessing, you know, for them to not know, but they do know. So yeah, I think autonomy is huge. And just that want to try, the way that one guy said it, you've given me back my want to try, which I didn't do anything. It was him talking through and realizing there's still things he can do, but also, it, you know, relying on that caregiver to give me feedback. Like I call it, like, you know, I don't know if this is true or not. I'm not Italian, but how Italians would cook noodles and they would tell that it was finished by throwing a noodle on the wall. And if it would stick, it was done. I don't know if that's true, but we talk about that in therapy. Let's just try this. If it sticks, great. And if it doesn't, so, you know, just to have permission, this might not work. Doesn't mean that you've lost more brain cells. It just might not work for you. So let's try something else.
You're taking the pressure off, which is so important, because that pressure can affect our executive functioning skills.
Absolutely. Huge. And that's whether it's dyslexia in childhood or not, you up that pressure. And anxiety can sabotage the best of efforts. But yes, with dementia, definitely, definitely. Yes.
Yeah. And I'm wondering too how you are noticing the emotional or logistical benefit that you have, your being there has on the caregivers, the wives in your practice.
I mean, what I'm hearing, so I set out wanting to pulse intervention, and this is because the literature, especially with a type called frontotemporal dementia, which is what one of mine has, that the literature says it's best to pulse. So you have intense, massive, frequent therapy, and then you back off and you see how they do for a month or two, and you're staying in touch with the caregiver. So that's been an option for them. But the wife has, on that particular client, the wife has said, please, we need you every week. We need you every week, or we want you every week. Just that emotional support this is one of my pet peeves about insurance. They're not going to reimburse me to work with the caregiver. And yet that's the person who's got boots on the ground with my patient every single day. So working with the caregiver is huge. If I were to draw like a pie and divide it into the quadrants for what we target, half of it would be the caregiver. So my caregivers are telling me that the emotional component of what my encouragement provides is gold to them. They don't want to pulse. They don't want to. Now, I will pulse. I will reduce the intensity. If that's what the literature is showing me is the best way for that type of dementia, then maybe I'll focus more on the caregiver during that time I would normally take off from the client himself, but still having contact with the client. She's telling me, I don't want you to break contact. We need this encouragement, which is so sad to me that's not more available in our country.
I agree.
I see insurance saying things like, so with frontotemporal dementia or FTD, it's one of the dementias that is showing nothing works to slow down the progression. So that's so cruel to me, when other types of dementia, there are strategies you can do that will let you maintain. In other words, it can slow the progression, but not with FTD. So insurance says, well, yeah, why should we reimburse you? There's no therapeutic value in counseling. I mean, speech language therapy. And yet that's the guy who got up and tried to make himself a cup of coffee. So tell me that's not a service that is worth something for that person, that moment, that day. So I also do something because my first career was as a violinist with the Arkansas Symphony. I also will bring my violin because music is a carrier for language. And so I will play my violin. And in this one case, a person might be speaking in 3 and 4 syllables, and they may not know who the president is. They can't pull that up when I ask in the moment, but man, I play their favorite hymn and they've got the lyrics for three verses. And then when they're done, they're like, they know what they did. They did that. And I was not singing. I was playing my fiddle. So, but they were singing and that feeling of, I can still do something. I can still do that. And then the memory associations with those songs that are in rote memory. It's just a beautiful thing to see. So music is part of what we incorporate. I am not a music therapist, and I'm careful to say that. That's a protected title. But anybody can use music if you know why you're doing it and how to apply it. So,
that's another part of the systemic problem, right? I mean, if you're a physical therapist, you can't work on emotional health. And if you're a mental health therapist, you can't we can't encourage clients to, but we can't tell them like, hey, walking can do this for your brain function. Like you have to be a PT to do that. And you can't use music and I think we are really starting to realize, I think that's a lot of the private pay practitioners too are realizing there is this restraint with insurance, and I don't want to be restricted because that's not how life works. We need a holistic approach.
Yes, absolutely. I think our country has become so stovepiped. Is that the right term? Like, you know, a specialist here, a specialist there, but man, it's communicating and sharing what each person can do. You know, I say on my website, nobody knows everything, but together each person can know more. And then that's what we can offer our people. You know, I'm not a mental health counselor, but I know that music can cheer somebody up. And I can play a song that I see lights them up like a Christmas tree. I will sure do that.
Right.
But I'm not pretending to, to unpack their emotions. I just know that being optimistic is one of the principles of neuroplasticity that helps you learn. And because incoming information, when it hits your limbic system, the little amygdala is like a guardian gateway to your limbic system where emotions are processed. And if you are positive and you are optimistic, laughing, there's humor involved, then when something that primes you for learning, because information coming to that amygdala, the amygdala says, great, come on in, sends that information onto the hippocampus. And then in sleep, it is consolidated into long-term memory. That's learning. So, and only in sleep, which is why cramming for exams rarely works. But if you're depressed, if you're angry, then incoming information gets to your amygdala and it says, whoa, I've got more important things going on. I'm dealing with something else, and that information doesn't make it to the hippocampus. So no matter how much sleep you're getting, there's not going to be consolidation of learning there, consolidation of memory. So I think emotions play a huge part in speech and language and in dementia. For that reason, you can prime them so that they are more receptive to trying the strategies we're working on or whatever.
Yeah, I love the way that you explained all of that. When it comes to like being positive, being happy, I think sometimes my field gets a little too hung up on how much of a choice that is. But if you're not experiencing someone playing music with you, you know, if you don't have anyone coming in and doing that, and music was a love of yours, or if you can't, you know, you can't drive anymore, you can't make it out to like your weekly meetup with the guys, or, you know, the things that you used to do are taken away. You can't just choose to be happy. And that's where we need people to come in and help support us in that way.
I agree.
Yeah. But yeah, it's so true. One of the ways that I describe the amygdala situation is like your amygdala sends out more signals than it can receive, and so when you're in a heightened emotion, your fear is just it's shooting these signals out, and it can override any logic. When it's calmer, when it's feeling good, now it can accept that logic.
Yes, Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. That's right. And we all want, regardless of our field, we all want our clients, I don't care, OT, PT, speech, mental health, nursing, we all want our clients to be independent as long as possible. And that's one way we can, I think if we can encourage that, like you said, calm, if we can, you know, downregulate if they start to, if they're spiraling out, if there are things we can do to help them downregulate. I know with brain injury, it's that way too. You can get overstimulated visually, you know, lights are too bright. You can get overstimulated auditorily, too much noise, crosstalking when there's, you know, more than one person visiting with you. Even tactily, you can become overstimulated in too many people around you. And so if we can help them downregulate by reducing that overstimulation, all of that helps that amygdala.
So many ways to do that, right? Which is why I think all of our work is starting to kind of overlap a little bit. Again, especially those of us in private pay, like we all have our specific kind of skill set, but at the end of the day, we are just providing community and support and helping to take off some of those blocks from the amygdala. Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Yep.
It's so there's so much overlap here. You know, we're talking about dementia, which is a, you know, degenerative brain disease that you can see on scans, whereas something like fibromyalgia or ADHD or something like that is not something you can really see on a scan. But so much overlap.
Yes. It's one reason I stayed in that private practice group, even though I figured out I'm the only speech language therapist in it, but you all are mental health counselors and therapists in that group. But I'm so interested. I read some of the comments and I'm like, that makes a lot of sense for speech language therapy also. So.
Yeah, it's hard, you know, trying to like to be interdisciplinary. Especially when egos get in the way and it's like, no, this is how we target this symptom. And someone else is like, no, this is how we do it. And it's like, well, first of all, each individual is different. So you do something should actually be changing with each, you know, with a structure in place, but it should be changing based on the individual you're working with because your one approach might not work with the other one.
That's exactly right. I've got one guy who has Parkinson's, and there is a dementia component with his, but I would love for him to, so I'm trained in hippotherapy, the movement of the horse, which helps
can you
a
say
lot.
It sounds like hypnotherapy.
I'm sorry.
Hippotherapy.
From the Greek word hippos, for the little part of your brain, the hippocampus that looks like a horse. It's an unfortunate name, I think.
And what does it do?
So hippotherapy is using the movement of a horse therapeutically. So basically, it is the vestibular input of the movement that helps align the central nervous system to prime it for learning. So I might start out in the barn with a task before putting the client on the horse, take data, then put them on the horse, have our time in the arena, then do the same task afterwards. And there will be often stunning, marked improvement from the vestibular input. Other times it might be tasks we do while they are on the horse. But anyway, this one guy is very interested in that. And probably in January, we're going to start going to a place that, anyway, I've worked it out. To do that, it's a big deal because you have to have four people for every session on a horse. You have to have, so it's heavy, a volunteer dependent. So you have the person leading the horse, you have a sidewalker on the right, the therapist on the left, the client up in the saddle. So if you don't have a leader and a sidewalker, it's not safe. That's how I was trained with the American Hippotherapy Association. But anyway, he's very interested. He wants to do that. He's always loved horses. He has, you know, that's part of his past. But I've got another guy who's like, yeah, not interested. So that noodle didn't stick on the wall for him. But so you're right. It has to be customized. You know, I'm not going to keep telling somebody, well, you, this would benefit you if they're not, you know, it has no meaning. It's not salient to them. So I think that's important.
Yeah. And there are a few different psychotherapy or just theories, like the theory of nonviolent communication, the theory of Hakomi therapy. There's a major component of basically all advice is violent.
Oh.
And I mean, that can obviously be seen, taken, I mean, it's a little extreme to kind of say it in that way. But when you are working with people, you realize it comes back to that autonomy. If they don't have autonomy of choice, now there's a fight going on inside of them and you too. So that's where the violence comes in. And so we want to just be with and support. And it doesn't mean we don't offer suggestions or encourage, you know, but there's an art to doing that. That clients are, autonomous and it gives them more power.
What was that therapy you mentioned? Hakomi?
Hakomi. H-A-K-O-M-I. And it's a very like mindfulness based practice. And it's quite interesting. It's all about the emotions and kind of the internal experience rather than here's what, you know, where in cognitive behavioral therapy, it's like, oh, you have this irrational thought. Here's this skill to like help you stop thinking that way. And it's like, the brain doesn't really work that way. You know, you don't really just change your thoughts. You might have a practice where you say, you know, oh, that's not a helpful thought. But what really changes your thoughts? And for me, it's the support, the community.
Yes. It's
seeing other people, like this brings me back to your role with the caregivers.
Yes.
And just them seeing you be patient with their partner allows them to have a model. And hopefully more patient too.
Yes. And my people are telling me that just being heard, just the caregiver will say, I just needed you to see what I'm seeing in the closet every morning. Like, am I going crazy? Like, you know, just feeling heard, having an outside source there in their home, seeing what she's seeing helps her feel affirmed also. And then part of my role too, as yours, I'm sure too, is getting them I can't force them, but again, just offering community support. So just, you know, I see them once a week. Right now, I mean, that's what they're opting. I'm available to do more, as my caseload fills up, probably not, but right now that's sufficing. Once a week is sufficing, but that's just me once a week. I really would love to see my people because the literature shows too that prognosis is better when you're interacting with others. So get outside your home. There are support groups I'm sure there are for chronic illness. There are for dementia. There are support groups and a lot of them are online. So you don't have to leave your home, which there are pros and cons to that. But just meeting other people that are going through what you're going through, that's especially important for caregivers, I think.
Yeah, I noticed such a shift in therapy when we moved to virtual. And some therapists are like still kind of like anti, like they feel like you can't be as effective, which I think is ludicrous. Yeah. But when I'm seeing a client in their house and I notice like, the way they get distracted by their environment or the way that something happens that I never would have seen in my office.
Exactly. Yes.
It gives them much richer content.
Exactly. And one of the things I work on is dysphagia, which is a feeding swallowing disorder. So, and for that, I do require a referral to rule out pathology. But and this happened with one of my people. We can eat in their home. We have breakfast together and I'm watching and there's absolutely no problems. This is a familiar environment. But when we go out to eat in a restaurant, I saw some significant problems with mastication. They weren't chewing their food. They were, for whatever reason, distracted. And so food was getting swallowed too. The volume and the rate were too fast, really put them at risk for aspiration. So we were able to find some strategies. You're going to go out to eat. These are social people still. So then put him with his back to the room where he's not going to have all that visual distraction. So you're right. That's not something I would have seen even in their home. Like, we've got to get out in the community for some of these daily functions like eating and drinking, you know, and how safe are they? Because with dementia, there is a component of the motor problem that starts to unravel too, especially like with Parkinson's disease, where let's get a baseline on their swallowing now, because that might be something that starts to really unravel. And then you can die. I mean, you get aspiration pneumonia, and that's very hard to come back from. So then I can teach you some exercises to strengthen the musculature here to try to keep that preserved, that function preserved as long as possible. So those are things you're not going to see in a clinic when somebody comes into your therapy room. And like I said, probably not even in their home. I didn't see any problems eating breakfast with this gentleman, but boy, we sure saw it when we had lunch out in a restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, having that interdisciplinary approach, because if, you know, they're a therapist, a mental health therapist who specialize in working with dementia as well, but the toolbox is different. And if they don't know about the way these vocal cords or the neck muscles are working, and they're just, okay, well, you're just anxious when you go out. And it's like,
oh gosh, right.
You know, if that's what's happening, and I'm not saying that that's all mental health therapists would say or do, but if they're not extra trained in some of this body-based stuff, then that could be a conversation. And just understanding like sensory overload and how that's not just, I think our field just historically has been like, it's in your mindset. There's a lot of choice. And it's like, if the lights and the talking and all of that is building up in my stress bucket,
that
muscles don't work as well.
Yes.
And that's the problem. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. We lose, all of us, we lose a certain degree of intentionality, I think. And with feeding and swallowing, especially when you get to a point where there's some degeneration of control, you have to be so intentional about how slowly you're chewing and swallowing and not talking and chewing at the same time, which we all are guilty of when there's a group. But
and imagine 60, 70, 80 years of being able to just talk and chew and not think twice about it. You have no muscle memory that says, no, you should keep your mouth, you know, closed and chew intentionally until you're done. Then, like, that's so much cognitive work.
No.
And there's, of course, in a stressful environment. And when we say stressful environment, again, that could literally just be a noisy restaurant.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's hard. And that's, I think, again, just having someone to model those things. Whereas the wife, she's not she's modeling whatever she's used to chewing, like, you know, so that's where the support comes in from the professional, but then also teaching the other people around, like, can we all chew a little slower if they're on board with that level of change?
Yes, right. And that's what, you know, we do that with our rate of speech, because dyslexia, it doesn't matter, a slower rate of speech, whether you are a child like that or with dementia, these are people that have, or they wouldn't be getting speech language therapy. They all have language processing or information processing barriers. So if we can slow down our rate of speech, it helps them track what we are saying. And so, but that's hard, because I get passionate and I start, you know, machine gun speaking, and then that's just harder for my people. So I'm trying to change my rate of speech to match where they are with ability to track information.
I'm the same way. I am in Georgia now, but I'm originally from Connecticut, and it's just the North versus the South. Like there's
yes.
And that was actually really hard for me when I moved down here. I actually felt like I couldn't comprehend the slower speech because my brain was working so fast. And I have clients now sometimes where like they either are from the North as well, or they just have a faster speech processing. And it's very interesting because on one hand, it is harder to understand when we're talking slower if you're used to that fast speech.
Right.
But on the other hand, you're also still, when you're talking that fast and you're going back and forth, like you might be carrying this conversation, but nothing seems to be like grasping and like holding on that they can then take with them and like remember post session.
Yes.
We really do have to. So then I work with them. I will meet them where they're at and talking as fast as they are because I have that ability still. But then I bring it down and I slow it down. And it's interesting to see where the frustration can start to occur. Like the slower and slower I go, I can see like their eyes or their attention just like moving. And then I can pay attention to that for them and just notice.
Yes. So we call that in my field, we call that the pragmatics of communication, the social pragmatics. So the body language, the eye contact, you know, how are they, where's it, where's the communication breaking down? And sometimes just bringing that to their attention. I know just last week, we were in a session and the wife was telling me that the husband completely, and it's the husband with dementia, that he completely stops participating, like in a group. She said he's there, he smiles, but she said I think he can't keep up. Well, getting him to try to express, and so no affect, I mean, he's there, he's pleasant. But she said he just stops participating. Well, it's because he couldn't track. He couldn't, and he was too embarrassed to say, I don't know, you know, slow down. And so he was able to, in that moment, tell his wife, he says, I feel walked on. Those were his words. I feel walked on when everybody's talking and I can't participate. It's like I don't matter. I'm invisible. And so that was really profound for her to hear because he had never expressed that before. So then we're able to talk about giving a signal. Like I told him, I said, before you get to your tipping point, like you called it a stress bucket, for me, I get overstimulated. Maybe it's my background as a musician, but for me, sounds make me come unglued. I can handle much more visual distractions than I can sound. I get irritated. And he said, yeah, for him, it's being irritated, but he hides it. Like nobody would know that. He hides it because I don't know. I don't know if he's like that socially I'm pretending. I don't know if he's that aware.
I have actually experience with this myself and I don't have dementia, but and that's what I mean. There's so much overlap here. It's just so mind-boggling. But yeah, when I start to become overstimulated in a social setting, it isn't necessarily how fast people are talking, or it's more like if I don't understand maybe the context of what's happening and I want to engage, but then like there's so many different things that can make me feel overstimulated.
Yes.
Once that happens, I shut down.
And
I can look really, I've gotten this feedback, like I can look cold, I can look disinterested. And so being aware of that, it's a little bit of like, there's acceptance work that has to be done in that of like, you can't always change your environment, right? And so there are still situations I go into where I preemptively remind myself, like, this is going to be like a backseat environment for you. Like you're going to be in the backseat here.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in other situations, it's like, oh, here's how you can actually maybe maneuver things in the environment so that you can stay involved. And that just depends on the situation and who's there and how safe or trustworthy each member of the who's there. So it's just so, it's so, and it wasn't, that was not conscious before. Like in my early 20s, there was no cognitive awareness of that. So it's not just like a choice of, oh, I'm going to like be cold now. It was literally a preservation method that my body just automatically put me into.
Yeah.
That was reinforced with feelings of safety over and over and over again. So it's very, very like, it's not cognitive, you know, I mean, meaning it's not
conscious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we call that metacognition. That's that being aware, because then you can be your own therapist, right?
Totally.
That's like that's my goal. Like if you're aware, you're getting to your tipping point. What can we do before you get there? What can we do? With my guys, we talked about like you need to give your wife a signal so she can help you. And if that means you getting up and removing, because this happens with brain injury too, not that dementia is the same, but some of the features are the same and the way of coping can be similar. So with like brain injury, if you're overstimulated, if you cannot physically get up and remove yourself from the stimulation because, I don't know, you're in a wheelchair or you just don't know that you can, then you will, if you cannot remove yourself from it, you will implode. You go into yourself and you disappear and you see it. You know, they're gone. Like you almost wonder, are they having a stroke? That's a self-preservation. They've gone in. They've tried to. That's their way of blocking out the I know I'm simplifying it, but a way to control the amount of stimuli that is getting to them.
That's right. And I mean, in mental health, we would call it dissociation, which some people consider dissociation to only be like this dissociative identity disorder, multiple personalities. That's dissociation is such a spectrum. And that's what we're doing. We're dissociating from our body to protect ourselves. And again, it's not even a conscious choice.
Right.
Your body's just doing it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I told this guy and his wife, I said, you need a signal, and probably a verbal one won't work because where it's happening is where there's lots of cross talking. And so a verbal signal, she's probably not going to pick up on that. A tactile signal, if you're sitting next to her, might work, but maybe a gesture. So for this couple, he suggested on his own, we talked through and he on his own, because it's going to be more meaningful than if I tell him, you know, what to do. He said he's going to do this with his nose. And then he made a joke. He said, I'll be careful what finger I use for that, which I thought that was funny. He still has a sense of humor, right?
Yes.
Humor and poetry are the highest forms of any language. And so anyway, we had a good laugh over that. And so I'll be interested to hear next week in our session, because they had a lot of family coming over, how that. So the deal is he gives her the signal. And then she's to encourage him to, maybe they'll go, hey, let's go step out for a minute, or she will just ask him, hey, you know, why don't you go check the car? I don't know what they're going to do, but that's her signal to try to assist him to leave that situation for the moment. And then breathing deeply, stepping outside. So he's removing some of that feel, that all that overstimulation that's making him feel walked on.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. We're going to try it. But having that awareness, man, like then I know I've done my job. If he can be aware of what's happening and then he can adjust his reaction to it, then he can be his own speech therapist in a sense. And then I've done my job.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you called it the tipping point, which is a really good way to put it. The more you become aware, I teach my clients this with their own body awareness issues that they have. And usually when we're first learning to become aware, we can only, like, we only find that awareness once we are at the tipping point. So then if we can reflect on that, okay, what did that feel like?
Right.
What did that sound like? Like, if we reflect on that without judgment, then we can figure out, okay, well, what's like a level 9 out of 10?
And then that's good.
You know, so we work backwards, and eventually we can find 7 out of 10. Ideally, we would know at a 2. Like, I might only need a quick glance out the window rather than getting up and walking all the way outside and taking this huge break. And it's like, okay, when I look out the window, that gives my nervous system a bit of a reset.
I like that. I like that. And I like numbers scaled like that. You know, hospitals use pain, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in? That gives them, something concrete to hang their emotions on in the moment, or how they're feeling, or, you know, their physical level of discomfort. I like that.
I will say with the pain, well, from like a chronic pain perspective, a lot of clients hate the pain scale because it feels so arbitrary. But
yeah,
when we talk about it in this context, the pain scale is your own personal scale and it becomes meaningful.
I like that.
Yeah. Rather, you know, than this thing in the hospital, it says, what level pain are you at? So as if that's going to tell them like what medicine to give you or something.
And right.
Get a,
right. You know,
but yeah, when you make it meaningful to you, like this is my level 10. So my level 10 is when I can no longer hear the 10 people.
Oh, I like that. That's a good distinction. I like that. Yeah, you're right. Personal, unique to that person.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my level 10 might not be your level 10.
And again, taking away like the, so for me, a lot of my clients, the work we do is so much shame, so much about like what our abilities are. And so even when we're talking about what's my level 10 versus yours, it's like, okay, well, how loud does the room need to be before I dissociate? And for you, it might be, you know, this 10 people in the room. For me, it might only be three, like, you know, three people talking at once and I'm already dissociating out of my body. So we figure that out by reducing the shame and just bringing awareness, mindful awareness, observing without jumping in too quickly to try to fix.
Right.
Then we kind of can get to the solutions later on. And that often does require another healthcare professional, depending on what the particular symptom is.
And I'm teaching my people a script that I want them to not even have to think about what to say to self-advocate. Like in the moment, the husband already last week, for the first time, I heard him say, one of my guys, his wife and I were getting all excited about Christmas, talking back and forth. And he was right there and he just put his two hands up on either side of his face. And he just said, please, one at a time. Mm-hmm. And it was great because that was the first time I'd seen him self-advocate. But it was just a script, please, one at a time, which was interesting to me because she and I were not cross-talking. It was just she and I, and we were taking turns in our conversation, but it was too fast. And for him, that felt like more than one person was talking at the. So that was his. I guess that gets back to your scale is unique to the person. He felt like more than one person was talking. So for him, it works to say, please, one at a time. And then that cued us. Okay, we're talking too fast. Even though it was interesting, too, because he wasn't part of that discussion, but he wanted to be, you know,
right.
He wanted to be. So.
And this takes so much understanding of the emotional side of things too, especially for the caregiver, because I can imagine how easy it would be to be like, we weren't talking over each other and you know, to kind of like argue. And it's hard to be in that caregiver space where you kind of don't have an option but to be the one who submits.
Yeah.
You know?
Good point. Yes.
You're not the one with a brain injury. And it doesn't mean you can't take care of yourself or you always have, like, there's things that we do to help you still feel like this whole person in the relationship. But yeah, it's like, okay, I have to pause what I am doing because you physically can't understand. And logically, we get that. But emotionally, that's just really hard to engage in on a day-to-day basis.
That's true. And I tell my people that with dementia, the last thing the person loses is emotion. And therefore we say, let them, like, you don't ever argue with somebody who has dementia. They lose a lot of the ability to some of the logic involved in being able to understand somebody else's perspective. They kind of, that goes. So we say, as the disease progresses, don't argue with them if they insist that Aunt Jane is in the next room and you know she has been in heaven for 12 years or whatever. Don't argue with them. If it gives them joy to think that Aunt Jane is in that next room, then let them think that. Because that emotion, if it's positive emotion, I would say probably try to redirect if it's causing them, if the emotion is creating anxiety in them. But if it's a positive emotion, let them have it. Right. That's what I say.
Yeah.
So you're right. The caregiver, I like what you how you said that. They almost by default have to be the one to submit to the person with the chronic condition, in this case, dementia. Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of our work kind of comes in, especially if there's been a traumatic history, if one, especially if the partner with dementia has been abusive emotionally or physically.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, that's where like my work probably starts to come in all of this. And there are therapists who, like I said, mental health therapists who specialize in this work, but from that perspective, and again, it's a lot of the caregiver work, and there's only so much you can do on the end with the person with dementia from a mental health perspective.
So I'm curious, like, as I have my antenna up for what my people need, I'm clear on my scope and what things I can do to facilitate their quality of life. But what might be something I can be aware of where it might be time to refer them to a mental health professional?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're seeing,
like you said, abuse or
which you might not know, right? I mean, if the wife has been with the husband for 30 years, like they're not showing you the signs that they've been abused. They clearly have they've been in it for so long, and it could be emotional abuse, which is a lot harder to. And then you know, people, if their dementia has progressed to a place where they're mean, and the wife is now having to, like we've said, submit to that.
Yeah.
You might not know what the history was there. Like, are they just being mean now because they have dementia and that's like a part of what they're experiencing? Mm-hmm. Or has this always been actually a part of what they, of how they've been? And now they just can't even control any part of it because of the disease. So that's a part of it. I think noticing like, resistance, like a lot of resistance to what you're trying to teach. Again, more so the caregiver rather than the, because the resistance will come right with dementia. You know, that, so there is some intuition that has, like, is this resistance because this is just hard, or like, is there's a lot of like personality stuff that's going on
that,
you know, needs
to be addressed. Yeah, so I'm hearing you say that as I'm watching these couples, that probably it's the caregiver who would benefit from mental health counseling more than the person with dementia.
That's my educated guess. Yeah, I would say for someone, I don't specialize in dementia, but that's so any therapist listening to this, feel free to email me. I'm happy to correct it in the next episode. But
I didn't realize in your field that there are, I mean, it makes sense. Same with speech therapy, that I would need to ask you to look for a counselor who specializes in dementia, probably.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard because I think a lot of us don't know how to like market ourselves appropriately. So you might not even know. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I send someone. And I know the therapist and I know the work they do, and their website like doesn't speak to it at all. So that's just because we're not taught marketing, and it's a whole other language. But so it's hard. It's, you know, now on Psychology Today, which is like a directory for mental health therapists, you can check off which things you work with. Now some people just go and check off everything. Other people are very, you know, specific. Like, I only check off things that I really have extra training in.
Right.
And so it just depends. It can be hard. It can be hard to find somebody. But I think that the best first step is probably going to Psychology Today, filtering your requests to therapists who you can even filter by insurance if you need that. And then filtering like by specialty. So if they have dementia checked off. Again, they might not be an expert in dementia, but at least it gives you a starting point of, okay, well, they at least checked it off. Can I reach out to them and see, like, is my client someone that they
And you can do some of that legwork. Like you can call them and you can ask them about their experience working with dementia before you give that referral. Or you can give the wife or the partner the referral and say, I think this may be a good fit. Might or might not be.
Okay.
Yeah. But, or if there's just a lot of grief, you know, again, the caregiver. So yeah, I am happy to be corrected on this if anyone's listening, but a lot of the stress, because also, I mean, managing the stress of this for the caregiver is going to help for the person who has dementia. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So
good.
This has been so great to talk about. I love having these interdisciplinary conversations.
Me too.
People figure out, you know, where to go and who to get help from. So
I wanted to mention a book that my patients introduced to me. This is by Pam Kovacs Johnson. It's called Did I Remember to Tell You? It's a real life guidebook for dementia family caregivers.
Okay.
And it is an easy read. It's just a paperback, but my people that I see all know each other and they're all in a book club together. And this
That's
is
so one. Sweet.
Yeah. So anyway, I speak highly of that book. That would be a good one for, I think, mental health also to read and be aware. It could be recommended.
Yeah. And I'll put that in the show notes so people can check that out. Amazing. Is there anything else you want to leave people with today?
Just, you know, with dementia, I love thinking of, I mean, couching it in this framework as a chronic illness. When we look at the projection with baby boomers and what dementia is looking like for our country in the next 5 years, it's pretty staggering. I think it would behoove all of us to educate ourselves as much as possible. You know, it's out there, and it's out there for all of us. We are an aging country, and more than ever because of the size of the boomer population. But just to educate ourselves and not, you know, there's Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's website is, I think it's just ALZ.org, Alzheimer's, yeah, ALZ.org. There's a wealth of information there. And so I would just encourage people rather than, well, I don't know anybody with dementia, so I'm not going to, why waste my time going there? You might recognize symptoms in somebody you know. And so anyway, I guess just awareness. I want to encourage people to be more aware that dementia is a spectrum, you know, from mild cognitive impairment all the way to full-blown dementia, that there are many kinds of dementia. They're not all the same. So just to be aware, I think would bringing awareness to something is always empowering, I think.
Yeah. But anyway, like, and my kind of last thought follow up on that is just when it comes to fear, you know, these things can be really scary to think about.
Yes.
But I think what we're illuminating here is that with community and with support, it's manageable. There's still grief, there's still hardship, but it's a lot easier than just trying to do it alone, which our country is really good at trying to do.
Then I also just let me tag on to that to give people permission to interview their caregivers. I don't mean like their spouses, but like if you find an outside support and it's not a good fit, it may not be a good fit, right? So to give yourself permission to say, I don't really like that speech therapist. I'm going to find somebody. In other words, not to think that it's the end of the world because you didn't mesh with the first person you went to for help.
Right. So I say the same thing for mental health therapy. So I love that you said that. Amazing. Thanks so much, Becky. I will put
all
the information in the show notes. And yeah, I'll let you know when this goes live. I'll send you an email. And yeah, thank you so much.
And if anybody is interested in my website, it's ArkansasSpeechLanguageTherapy.com.
Perfect. Yeah. And I'll add that to the show notes.
Well, thank you, Destiny. Appreciate you having me. And good luck.
Thanks so much. All right, we'll be in touch. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If you learned something new today, consider writing it down in your phone notes or journal and make that new neural pathway light up. Better yet, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a DM on Instagram, email me, or leave a voice memo for us to play on the next show. The way you summarize your takeaways can be the perfect little soundbite that someone else might need. And lastly, leaving a review really helps others find this podcast, so please do if you found this episode helpful. And P.S., clicking subscribe ensures you'll be here for the next episode. See you then.